I found the In Accord interesting how we look at education and how blessed we are to be educated in the truth of God and the knowledge that God shares with us. And I think my message today ties into that. Mrs. Epperson, I'm assuming she's the late Ray Epperson's mother, actually. She isn't? Okay. That was his wife? Oh, okay. I apologize. Well, she made an interesting comment about how participating in the education programs actually informs her how to pray for how God is educating the next generations, right? I'm going to talk about that today, the generations. I recently came across an article that discussed character traits of a generation that was called the greatest generation. The greatest generation was a term that was coined by Tom Brokaw. He was sent on assignment in 1984 to Normandy in France, and they were having the 50th anniversary celebration of the battle at Normandy Beach, what they called D-Day. And many veterans from the war at the time were there for that memorial time and to commemorate that very sobering experience. And it was from that event and that being there and talking to these individuals that he began a quest to go interview and get to know people from this generation that he eventually coined the greatest generation and memorialized in a book called The Greatest Generation. I think it came out in 1998. How many have had a chance to read this book? If you have not, I would recommend it. It's a great, great read. It just tells stories of people from a generation. I'm going to start the message off by reading about one of the individuals that he writes a biography on, and it's a number of individuals that he does. Just got to get to the right page here. The individual's name is Thomas Broderick. Thomas Broderick. And I'll jump into his story. Thomas Broderick was a 19-year-old pre-med student at Xavier College in Cincinnati in 1942, trying to decide which branch of the service fit his sense of adventure. I'm always struck when I read about a 19-year-old, being I have a daughter who's 17-year-old, thinking about college, and a 15-year-old daughter. This is a 19-year-old young man living in a time where young men tried to figure out what branch of the service they would go into. 1942, in the middle of what they called the Great War, World War II. Many of you grew up during that time. I want to talk about people from that time today, the generations. This son of a South Chicago working class family was bright and ambitious, so he enlisted in the Merchant Marine. They gave us the best deal, he said. If you didn't like it, you could quit. After 10 weeks of training, he went on a mission to North Africa on a supply ship. The pay was excellent, pretty important. 1942 was coming off of a decade where this young man would have lived through the Great Depression. And excellent pay wasn't the norm of the day. In fact, people lived to survive. Sounds like a pretty good job. The food was abundant. He had a private room on the officer's deck of the ship, the John W. Brown, but the trip was long and boring. Not good for an adventurous young man. He wanted out of the Merchant Marine. He wanted to join the Airborne so he could be like those cocky paratroopers he saw stationed in Algiers when he visited. I'd never been in a plane before, he says, but it was the challenge I wanted. His superiors in the Merchant Marine were astonished. Here he was, ready to go back to the security of the Merchant Marine Academy for another 18 months of accelerated training, and he wanted to quit. He wanted to quit to join one of the most dangerous outfits in the service during the middle of the war. His officer offered him a 30-day furlough to think it over. Broderick said, "No, my mind's made up." When he returned home, his parents were equally appalled. When he told his draft board what he wanted, the clerk said, "You're nuts." I've been called nuts before, but this guy was really nuts. "I'll give you another month before we draft you so you can change your mind." Broderick declined and said he wanted it now. Tom Broderick spent 17 weeks in basic training for the infantry in Mineral Wells, Texas, before heading to Fort Benning, Georgia, to become a member of the 82nd Airborne, a very famous airborne division. When he finished his training, a captain offered him an instructor's job and the rank of sergeant. Again, Broderick refused the safer alternative, saying he wanted to stay with his outfit and go overseas. Broderick's unit shipped out to England as replacements for the 82nd Airborne men lost in the Normandy invasion. In September, Broderick made his first jump into combat in Holland. He was in the thick of it immediately, the Battle of Arnhem. It was a joint mission of American and British paratroopers, and their objective was to take the Nijmegen Bridge to help pave the Allies' way into Germany and to discourage any German counterattack. We jumped at about 500 feet because we wanted to be a low target. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. He said, the first German I saw, I couldn't shoot because he was riding a bicycle away from me. I couldn't shoot at him because he wasn't shooting at me. Things were different 10 minutes later. There were Germans all over the place. They outnumbered us about 40,000 to 28,000. It was combat morning, noon, and night. On the fifth day, Broderick made a mistake that would alter his life forever. I remember being in the foxhole, and I was lining up my aim on a German. I got a little high in the foxhole, and I got a shot clean through the head, through the left temple. A Catholic chaplain arrived to administer the last rites, but after slipping into unconsciousness, Broderick somehow managed to stay alive until he awoke a few days later in a British hospital. He was relieved to be out of combat, but he had a problem. He couldn't see. Why not, he asked. His doctors told him, when that hemorrhage clears up, you'll be all right. Broderick continued to believe them until he was sent to Dibble General Hospital in Menlo Park, California, one of the two facilities in the nation treating blind veterans. Finally, a doctor told him the truth. He would be blind forever. I was stunned. I cried. Aren't you going to do anything? He rushed to a fellow veteran who had been hospitalized with him in England, a man recovering from shrapnel in one of his eyes. I just cried and cried. And he said to me, we knew the whole time, Tom. We just didn't want to tell you. Tom Broderick came back to the United States from combat in World War II to live his life, the rest of it, a blind man serving his country. At first, he rejected the idea of getting Braille, but the military convinced him that if he didn't learn it, it was going to be really hard to work and hold down a job and provide for himself or potentially a family. So finally, they convinced him to learn Braille. And at the same time, he decided to learn the insurance business. 6 days a week, he worked all day in insurance, and in the evenings, he learned Braille. And he became so good over the phone selling insurance that he eventually started his own company. And when he would meet initial clients for the first time, after having talked to them on the phone, guess what? He knew who they were. And he developed a very, very successful business over the rest of his life. I looked him up outside of the book, and I believe he died in 2006 at 81 years old. He was very successful in business, but he also spent a lot of time working with veterans, for example, from Vietnam, who came back from that war blind, and dedicated his life to working with blind veterans. One amongst many, part of a generation that now there's, I believe, 400,000, maybe slightly more than that, left out of 16 million people who served in World War II. They die at a rate of about 354 per day. It won't be long, and they'll be gone. They'll be gone. I met a couple of them, probably more than a couple. Many of us remember Bob Baldwin. He flew bombing missions in World War II. I also was very close to an individual, Dr. Lynn Torrance, down in Big Sandy, Texas. Some of you may have known him. I see Sarah nodding her head. Kind of beloved by many of us. Special man. He survived the Bataan Death March, and God called him. Generations that are different, unique, willing to sacrifice, willing to step out and give their lives. Men at that time didn't think twice about signing up to go to war. In fact, they felt it was their obligation to help save the world, to save their country. To go off to a war and give your life, they didn't think twice. You could read story after story after story. Nowadays, we watch on the news as people denigrate our military and our law enforcement. It was a different time, a different era. Tom Brokaw describes this greatest generation about which he wrote the book in this way. He said, I was simply talking about when he went for the commemoration of D-Day. He said, I was simply looking forward to what I thought would be an interesting assignment in a part of France celebrated for its hospitality, its seafood, and its Calvados, the local brandy made from apples. Instead, I underwent a life-changing experience. As I walked the beaches with American veterans who had landed there and now returned for their anniversary, men in their 60s and 70s at the time, and listened to their stories in the cafes and the inns, I was deeply moved and profoundly grateful for all they had done, that generation. Men who went to war, women who stayed back and helped keep the country together and the families together. I realized that they had been around, all around me all my life as I was growing up, and that I had failed to appreciate what they had been through and what they had accomplished. These men and women came of age in the Great Depression, when economic despair hovered over the land like a plague. I have parents that were born in the Great Depression. Some of you have parents that were a part of this greatest generation, or the ones that came from that generation. They call them the silent generation. They were born from 1925 to 1945, as my parents were and my in-laws were. A different generation. They were born out of the Depression. Their thoughts, what shaped their lives and how they looked at life. These individuals, the greatest generation, had watched their parents lose their businesses, their farms, their jobs, their hopes. They had learned to accept a future that played out one day at a time. Then, just as there was a glimmer of economic recovery, the Great Depression lasted from 1929 to 1939, and suddenly it was going to get better, war exploded across Europe and Asia. When Pearl Harbor made it irrefutably clear that America was not a fortress, this generation, the greatest generation, was summoned to the parade ground and told to train for war. They left their ranches in Sully County, South Dakota, their jobs on the main street of America's Georgia. They gave up their place on the assembly lines in Detroit and in the ranks of Wall Street. They quit school or went from cap and gown directly into uniform. They answered the call to help save the world from the two most powerful and ruthless military machines ever assembled, instruments of conquest in the hands of fascist maniacs. The greatest generation, immortalized at least by this author, again, an excellent read if you haven't read it. A generation that's going away. A generation that has an analog in the church. We have people who sit in our audience today. Some are a part of that generation or that time. Many of them shaped and molded us. I was shaped and molded being raised by parents that were a part of that generation. Wouldn't it be a tragedy if we lose what they have given us? But for these people sitting in the audience today, or audiences in God's church all over the world, particularly in this country, because we're referring to this country, many of them are what we call first-generation Christians. They sacrificed things to respond to God's calling. And they came in the church. They accepted the calling. And to be sitting here today, they've had to sacrifice and they have had to be faithful. We have a generation we can not only learn from in the greatest generation, but generations in the church. I want to talk about that today, in the remainder of the time I have. I'm going to take four characteristics or character traits of this greatest generation. And eventually we're going to end on how important it is to learn. The greatest education that can occur outside of God educating us in His Word, it being expounded on, is the example and the teaching and the lives of the generations that come before us. We are a church that is becoming far removed from a first generation church. We are a second generation church. We are a third generation church. We are a fourth generation church. Do we learn? Education exists here, in this house, in this church, and our ability to continue the legacy of those that have come before us spiritually that have taught us will determine not only our own personal spiritual health, but the health of the church moving forward. The title of my sermon is Honor, Learn, and Pass It On. Honor, learn, and pass it on. The first trait that is often mentioned with the greatest generation is personal responsibility. People who were responsible in their minds, in their actions, in everything they did, they themselves were responsible for the choices they made, the decisions they made, the outcomes, good or bad. Good choices, bad choices. They owned them. They owned them when they were growing up. They owned them when they went off to war, and they owned them when they came back. You know, going back into the finish of the story on Thomas Broderick, this is how this short narrative ends. It says, Tom Broderick in so many ways embodies the best qualities of his generation. He was so eager to get involved in the war, he enlisted in two branches of the service. He was gravely wounded, but once he got over the initial understandable anger, he set out to be the best husband, father, businessman, and citizen he could be. Sight or no sight, he didn't grow bitter and dependent on others. He didn't blame the world for his condition. A common lament of the World War II generation is the absence today of personal responsibility. We see that in society. We live in a blame society. You can't turn on the news. You can't watch politics. It's blame, 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 blame. Nobody's responsible for anything except the other side. Individuals, blame, blame, blame. We live in the wine generation, not the drinking wine. The wine, the whining generation. That's what we live in, but not this generation. They were all about personal responsibility. Broderick remembers listening to an NPR broadcast and hearing an account of how two boys found a loaded gun in one of their homes. The visiting boy accidentally shot his friend. The victim's father was on the radio talking about suing the gun manufacturer. That got to Tom Broderick. So, he said, here's this man talking about suing, and he's not accepting responsibility for having a loaded gun in the house. Tom knows something about personal responsibility. This is how the story ends, at least Tom Brokaw's version. He's been forced to live, and I should say was forced to live because he's now passed on. He was forced to live as a blind man for more than 50 years, and when asked about the moment when the lights were literally shot out of his eyes, he says only, "It was my fault for getting too high in the foxhole. That happens sometimes. Personal responsibility. I was reading, as I prepared for this message, an excerpt from a commencement address to a university by a Robert Gresson Jr., who's the chairman and CEO of Blue Cross, Blue Shield. And the commencement address was entitled, Where the Buck Stops, Personal Responsibility in a Not-Me Society. I pulled from the commencement address this. He said, getting to a point where everyone does their part requires more than just a call to action. It will take a shift in a collective mindset that is developed because we have allowed an incredibly important trait to slowly leach out of our society's character. That trait is personal responsibility. There was an email going around for a while that I think raises an interesting contradiction about personal responsibility in America. It's an email that tells about the most ridiculous legal cases in the past few years. There was one story about a burglar who sued a family after getting locked in their garage while trying to rob their house. Supposedly, he was stuck there for 8 days. Good for him. Since the family was on vacation, forced to live on dog food and warm Pepsi. We can all clap. Another example told of a woman who sued a furniture store after she tripped over a misbehaving toddler and broke her ankle. The only problem was that the toddler in question was her own son. I know people that would probably do that. And perhaps most outrageous, this is a good one. This is a really good one. And perhaps most outrageous was the story of the man who sued Winnebago, the big RV company, when his 32-foot RV crashed after he set the cruise control and then went into the vehicle's kitchen to make a sandwich. It seems the manual didn't tell him he needed to stay at the wheel. The age of blame, the age of whining. You know, when the greatest generation accepted responsibility for something, they accepted the consequences. There's a story in the book about an individual, Wesley Coe, who got back from the war, he'd fought in the war, and he started a really successful business. And he decided to move it from Philadelphia to New York after the war, but it was going to cost him $1.3 million to move it at the time. So he personally guaranteed that money, and the move didn't go well. It buried his business. And when he was 70 years old, he decided to go back to work. He said, it was a big decision to make at the time. I couldn't retire. I hadn't taken out Social Security. So at the age of 70, I had to get a job and start paying back that bill, that million-dollar loan. I just didn't feel comfortable with declaring bankruptcy. I just didn't think it was the honorable thing to do, even though it would have been easier. I don't know about you, but one thing I never heard growing up, I never heard my parents blame anybody, anything, anyone, any circumstance for their lives. I never heard it. If things went well, I never heard them slapping their own backs. And if things went bad, they took responsibility. I've seen many people in this church over many decades come and go because they decided to blame something or someone in the church, in their lives, a parent, a sibling, a minister, and they don't sit here anymore. They're not here learning. They're not here reaping the rewards from a committed generation. Personal responsibility. Let's go to Deuteronomy 24, just one verse on this. You see, all of these things we discuss here, they're biblical in nature. They're profound principles that are throughout the Bible. In Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 16, very simply, the fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin, personal responsibility. One thing we learn from the greatest generation, and I think from the older generation in the church, is that they are personally responsible. It's a great lesson for the second, in the third, in the fourth generations to learn. By doing that, we honor, we learn, we live it, we implement it, and we pass it on to the next generation. It's godly. The second characteristic, I'm just going to give you four today, of the greatest generation, but we see in the generations in the church, is simply humility and modesty. When you read about this generation, that's one that's mentioned all the time. Humility. Humility. What does that mean when you talk about this generation? We talk about humility and its importance a lot in the church. But what does it mean in this generation? I'd like to read from an article written in May of 2014 for the Houston Chronicle by an individual named Joel Hawley. And he was writing about his cousin, a much older cousin at the time. And it's entitled, Why Cousin Bob and Other World War II Vets Dislike Telling War Stories. You see, World War II vets, they don't talk a lot about their heroics. We talk about them. We drag it out of them because we find it inspiring that people would do what they did. We wish our world, our country was more like that, more patriotic, more willing to sacrifice. But they're humble people. And when I say modesty, they're modest about what they've done. They're modest. We live in a world that brags. Social media is the new bragging institution. I can't imagine what these veterans think of social media. This article says, attached to a wall in a spare bedroom of my Aunt Eunice and Uncle Joe's home in Corsicana were three navy blue planes arranged in formation. They looked like model planes, but were heavier, precise in every detail. We could examine them, my brothers and I were told, but we certainly couldn't take them down and play with them. They were Bob's planes. I have to think you don't mess with a lot of these World War II vets either. I knew that my cousin Bob Hawley had been in the war. A war that in the 1950s seemed as distant to me as the Civil War. You see, these veterans that came back after World War II ended in 1945, they helped usher in something very different than what they grew up in, what they came out of, the Great Depression and war. They ushered in the greatest period that has been sustained to this very day of prosperity. And so their children, me, the baby boomers, my brother who was born in the 50s, we didn't know the world they came from. We heard about it. We heard about it. But we didn't know it because the greatest era of prosperity began. That war became distant. That depression, Great Depression, became distant soon. So it goes on here, he says, I didn't know much beyond the fact that he, Bob, had been a Navy pilot. Maybe I knew that he'd gone down over the Pacific, maybe not. He certainly didn't talk about it. Decades would pass before he told me the story. Decades would pass as well before I realized that Bob is typical. Combat survivors, particularly those of his generation, never saw much point in telling war stories, calling attention to themselves. Now, if there's a war hero, they fought in Iraq or they fought wherever, what do? They write a book, right? They write a book. They start a TV show. Not these people. They didn't write books. They didn't take to social media. What Bob went through on September 22nd, 1944 was not unlike what a 20-year-old named Bush had experienced just 3 weeks earlier. George H.W. Bush, the senior, the president, had been shot down and was held prisoner by Japanese. His plane was shot down. You know, the way Bob puts it is, as soon as we're gone, not one person's going to care what we experienced. That's why he didn't talk about his experience. But he was shot down. Bob 22 from Hillsboro was piloting a Grumman TBF Avenger off an aircraft carrier Altamaha near the Philippines. The Avenger, a torpedo bomber that first saw action during the crucial Battle of Midway in 1942, had three crew members: the pilot, a turret gunner, and a radio man or bombardier in the belly of the tail section. There were two planes in formation, Bob recalled. The plane right next to me got blown to kingdom come, and that plane got blown into me. The plane on his wing had been hit by ground fire from a nearby island. All three crewmen perished. And Bob's heavily damaged plane was within seconds of spiraling out of control. After giving the order to bail out and then clambering out of the cockpit himself, he hit his head and shoulder on the wing as he jumped, knocking himself out. He doesn't remember pulling the ripcord or detaching himself from his parachute. He remembers coming to when he swallowed seawater. He was in the water for about an hour. Although Japanese planes and ships were in this area, an American destroyer escort got to him first. An old salt on board the destroyer cured his seawater nausea with a swing of Australian rye. Bob's turret gunner didn't make it. Villanova Calderon was his name, Bob said the other day. I've thought about him a million times. I wrote his family, but I never heard back. Although he got to come home to Texas for a few weeks, the war wasn't over for Bob. He was shipped back to the Pacific as part of a squadron on the aircraft carrier Fanshawe Bay. See, if you weren't wounded in a way that would limit you, you were sent right back in. Different world, different era, different people. We knew where we were going, but we stopped and anchored off Okinawa. You'd step out on the flight deck, and as far as you could see, there were ships, American ships. We got to within 24 hours of Japan, and the war ended. So why do you think they didn't talk about what they'd gone through? I asked Bob's wife, Mary Ellen, the other day as we sat in the living room of their North Houston home. She said, I think they were all shell-shocked. She told me about waking up nights not long after Bob came home and finding him on the floor trembling. Or they'd go to a movie, and he would hold tightly to her in the darkness. He's told me about moments in the air when he had 30 or seconds or less to make the right decision. If he didn't, he and his crew died. A generation that had to make decisions in the moment when people's lives depended on it, who went through terrible things but never really talked about it. Humble, modest, they didn't brag about their exploits. And that day there was a norm of dignity and modesty. Society held itself to a higher standard, and humility was at the heart of that. I call this generation, this greatest generation, and those like them, as the actions speak louder than words generation. We live in a world today that's very different. But in the church, we see a generation that is similar. They don't brag. They don't talk about their exploits. They just work hard. They set an example. Their actions often speak louder than their words, though their words are often powerful. Let's go to Proverbs 27. Proverbs 27. You see, this principle is biblical. God doesn't want us to be the boasters, the proud, the arrogant, the braggarts. This is what he says through Solomon in verse 1 of Proverbs 27. Do not boast about tomorrow. This is verse 1. For you do not know what a day may bring forth. Verse 2. Let another man praise you and not your own mouth. A stranger and not your own lips. Praise should come from others. That's how the greatest generation live. Honor, learn, and pass it on. When we honor the older generation in our church, when we honor them by being interested in their lives, their challenges, how they've overcome, they're not going to tell you about it often, but we can ask. Then we honor, and by that we praise them. And more importantly, we praise God in that process. Because we're telling God we're interested in the next thing, and that is to learn. Learning not only by listening, learning not only by observing, which we do observe, but learning by implementing, by following their example, and then passing it on. The next generation must own it. The church must own this. I fear, I'm sure many of you fear, we can be in danger in the church of losing some of these things. Losing the importance of these values and principles, though we espouse many of them. Do we really live by them in the church? Is the second generation, the third generation, and the fourth generation really capturing these things? It is important to ask ourselves these questions, because this generation won't be around forever. There may be a day when we are just a second and a third and a fourth generation church. And there may be a day when it's just a third and a fourth and a fifth. Now is the time to honor, learn, and pass it on. The third characteristic or character trait of this greatest generation, and we see in the church, is work ethic. Work ethic. And what I'll add to that is resourcefulness. You know, I remember, you see, I grew up in a home with someone that, though he didn't fight in World War II, he was highly influenced by the Great Depression, because he grew up as a boy in it and highly impacted by the effects of the war. That was my father. And I remember a day I was in high school. It was actually during the summer. And I was working for my dad. I've told you about it. I had a tough job. Listen to me whine. 10 hours a day minimum, hot sun, weather like this, middle of July, August. But oh, I was paid well. So it was worth it. Now, I worked down in the ditches, I've mentioned. Big ditches, sand and dirt all around me, big machine digging a hole in front of me. And I was the lucky one. I got to slop up the pipes and help get them into the next pipe and then sit back while the hole was dug further for the next pipe to go in. We covered them up and we tamped them in. It was a dirty, grimy job, but my dad paid me well. Got paid well. This particular day, though, I showed up on the job, and the sun hadn't been up all that long because we started early, and I was just really happy. Got myself out of bed, alarm clock, got me up. I was even there a little bit early. Dad wasn't able to get on my case for that. Because in my dad's world of work ethic, it involved every little detail. Every detail. No stone was unturned. My daughters have no clue what their dad went through. They've experienced nothing like it. I wasn't allowed, after I put a pipe in, to sit on the side while the next pipe, while the hole was gotten ready for the next pipe. I had to go back up to the top and work in between. No one else had to do it, but I did. My brother did, because we were Don Erickson's sons. We never got to sit, never got to rest. And that day, I was excited. I was there early. If anything, Dad was going to give me a slap on the back. I was going to get my first one. Shut the car off, moved my legs out of the car, sat my boots down on the ground, and all of a sudden I saw my dad, who was there, come running towards me. I'm like, ha-ha. I'm going to get my congratulations. And then the full blast came. I wasn't even hardly awake yet. The volume was high. It was like a jet plane. But he wasn't happy. He was looking at my boots because they weren't tied. He was furious. Because if you showed up and you got out of your truck with your boots untied, You were sending the message, I'm not ready to go to work. That's the nice little easygoing, loving Don Erickson you all know. That's the world they lived in, they taught, and he had a very successful business, as did my uncle who grew up in that generation. You know, I was thinking a couple of years ago, I'm not teaching my kids a work ethic. I don't talk a lot about work. I mean, I tell them a little bit here and there, but I don't take them into work. They certainly don't work for me like I worked for my dad. What am I really teaching them? And then my oldest daughter said, I'm going to get a job, because we were going to tell her to get a job in between her 10th and 11th grade year in the summer, and she said, I'm going to get a job, and she got a good job at Target. Paid her pretty well. I was like, well, at least it's not a complete cataclysmic failure. We didn't have to tell her to go get a job. We didn't have to tell her. She actually came up and said she was going to do it. This summer, she's got 3 jobs. I had to tell her, slow down a little bit, Emmy. Slow down. But yet, Colleen and I failed. We failed. We didn't teach them enough. I wasn't going to push my younger daughter to work till next summer, in between her 10th and 11th grade years, but she said, I'm going to work this summer, Mom, Dad, and she's got a job at Subway. We've all had our Subway jobs, right? You know, we've all been there, right? At least the sandwiches are pretty good, and I get them for free, so that's all I care about. She said it's legal. You can give your parents free sandwiches. But we didn't teach them. Or did we? Or did you teach your kids? At the end of the day, great work ethic comes from our example, right? We work. We were taught to work, right? All of us here by that generation, we were taught to work. I wasn't the only one taught to work by my fanatic, crazy dad who had an idea on work ethic that I'm thankful for now, but we were taught to work. And so when we work, when we serve, when we set that example by doing what we were taught, by passing on what we learned from one generation, we pass it on to the next. There are other ways. If you own a business or you can take your kids into work and have them work with you, all the better. You can teach them hands-on. But we teach. You know, that generation had to learn to work hard because they'd grown up in the Great Depression. They had to be resourceful. They didn't have much. They had to work to literally put food on the table. The Great Depression started in 1929 and it ended in 1939. It peaked in 1933. In the first 5 years of the Depression, which started in 1929, the economy shrank 50%. Unprecedented. We've never heard of anything like it since. The Great Recession that we went through, which had its difficulties, paled compared to that. In 1929, economic output was $105 billion, which measured today would be about a little over $1 trillion. By the end of the first year, 6 months later, 650 banks had already failed. In 1930, the economy shrank another 8.5%, and by 1932, it shrank 12%. So the country had suffered years of economic contraction. It was half of what it was at the peak, about the time my father was born. Unemployment peaked out at 25%, but that doesn't speak to underemployment. A lot of people just subsisted. You know, during this time, another unfortunate tragedy happened, and that was the Great Dust Bowl. How many of you have heard of the Great Dust Bowl? Happened in our farming, the heart of our farming country, the Dust Bowl. Probably the greatest drought that our country has experienced in modern times. And it was a true drought, and it was also caused by poor farming practices. And so there was food shortages as a result. People had to get very resourceful. If you buy 12 dozen eggs today, you eat them. That's why you buy them. If you bought 12 dozen eggs or you got them back then, you'd eat them. Or you'd use them to trade with if you didn't have money. You know, today, if we buy our aluminum foil or what they call tin foil, then we wrap things, and then when we're done, we throw it away. Not that generation. They threw nothing away. You can read about the uses they had for tin foil. They would use it till they had to throw it away, till it had no more usefulness. It was a different era. During the Dust Bowl, a new phenomenon started, shanty towns. How many of you heard of shanty towns, or what they call Hoovervilles? Little towns popped up all over the country where little shacks would build up and communities would form and people would subsist and subsistence would live together. Maybe I have never asked my parents. Maybe they saw a shanty town. I don't think they lived in one. Over 1,000 of them popped up in the country. It was a very different time. People had to be hardworking. They had to be resourceful. They had to value a dollar, a quarter, a nickel, a penny. They came hard. And you had to be resourceful. Brokaw said this about his father. You see, you didn't typically buy something unless you had to. He said, my father, Red Brokaw, who was a part of the Greatest Generation, was a blue ribbon member of the Fix-It generation. My mother learned not to say aloud what she needed. Let's say a new ironing board, because my father would immediately build her one. She liked to buy something from the store occasionally, so she didn't want to mention it to his father, because then he'd just build it and she couldn't buy something. How many of us have built an ironing board? Probably some of you have. When I was a young man in need of spending money, I mentioned that I could mow many more lawns if I had a power mower. I had a snazzy new model from Sears Roebuck in mind. My father went to his workshop and built a mower using an old washing machine motor. He welded pipes for handles, a hand tool blade, and discarded toy wagon wheels mounted on a plywood platform. That was Tom Brokaw's first lawnmower. He painted it all black, and it was a formidable machine. At first, I was embarrassed, but then as it drew admirers, I was proud of its homespun place in a store-bought world. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 21. Proverbs chapter 21. Work ethic, resourcefulness, understanding the value of money. These are such important things to pass on. Proverbs 21 and verse 20, it says, there is desirable treasure. Is there anything more satisfying than when you fix something or you do something yourself? I put a new faucet in the kitchen sink because the other one was really nasty this week. And it looks pretty nice. That's because, you know, the faucet looks nice. And my daughters were kind of shocked. Like, Dad, you did that? I'm not a part of the fix-it generation. I usually break something apart, and it's so broken, I can't get it back together. And I'm calling my father-in-law, Errol, can you help me out here, or bail me out, or I just don't even try. Well, the dirty secret is the faucet's not real hard. You just got to do a couple of pipes, put the thing on, and attach the pipes again. And so I'm sorry, girls. I know it was very impressive, but it really wasn't all that impressive. There's work and treasure that's satisfying. Hard work. When you work hard, and it's not just about earning money, it's the satisfaction of hard work. It's fixing something. It's being resourceful. God made it that way. It says, an oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man squanders it. They don't understand that concept. In verse 5 of the same chapter, it says simply, the plans of the diligent, or the hardworking, lead surely to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty, surely to poverty. You know, when you look at the first generation, Colleen and I were talking about our parents, you know, they all have their spots specially designated for their hard work, the Bible study. My father-in-law has always had a desk just for Bible study, and he uses it every day. Maybe some of you have that special Bible study desk, because it's that important. Work ethic. The last of the four is what we call, very simply, faithful commitment. Faithful commitment. Now here, in terms of the greatest generation, I'm referring to their commitment to marriage and their families. Now, of course, we teach that in the church. It's a strong point of what we teach. But they were committed in a way that was very unique because they were committed through very, very difficult times and very, very good times. It's a commitment through the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because marriage and family has good. At times, there's some bad. Bad things can happen. Trials can enter. And sometimes there's even ugliness. Most families in here, if not all, have experienced that. But that generation had faithful commitment. You know, Tom Broderick eventually married Eileen, his wife. They dated when she was 23, and she came home that night. He was blind. She told her best friend, she said, "I'm going to marry this guy. I know it." She was that impressed with his work ethic, with what he stood for. She was a nurse. And her friend said, "You're drunk. You guys were out drinking." She said, "No, I'm not drunk. I wasn't drinking." And they got married. And the blind man who married the nurse, they raised 7 kids in Chicago. 7 kids together. And had a very successful life. You know, in that day and age, about 1 in 6 marriages ended in divorce. About 1 in 6. Nowadays, it's 1 in 2 in our society. And the other part of the facts that we don't often talk about is that, relatively speaking, marriage is becoming less occurring. It's down almost 10%, the institution actually of marriage, people getting married over the last quarter century. And sometimes people say, well, people are just getting married older, and that's true. But a lot of it, if you look into the statistics, is that people just are simply living together, starting families, and never getting married. It's just a different world. But that generation had commitment through the best of times and the worst of times. We were very recently at the wedding of my niece, my sister's daughter, Lindsay. And my parents were there, and my wife and daughters, and our family, my brother and his kids. And really a wonderful event. It was very happy to see her get married, and we really like the guy she's marrying, and all the good stuff. And early on in the dance, they had one I'd never been involved in. Maybe some of you have seen this, but the DJ said, "Okay, all of you who are married, come out and dance." And it was a slow dance. And so then after a few seconds, "Okay, those of you who've been married 5 years or less, you have to leave. And those of you married 10 years or less, you have to leave." And it started dwindling. Well, the bells of the ball, my mom and dad were already gone. Okay, they check out pretty early. They'd been there, and dad actually danced with my niece, the grandfather, you know, granddaughter dance, and I thought he's just going to do the nice dance with her at the beginning, and then suddenly he was out there juking and jiving, and Colleen and I were like, "No!" You know, and he was out there having a good time, and everybody was like, "Yeah!" You know, and he was kind of, he was the dude, you know, at the dance. And we were like, "No, this isn't good." But the bells of the ball, my mom and dad were gone. So as this thing went on, suddenly, Colleen and I were like, we might be it. It's 28 years tomorrow for us. We never thought of ourselves. You know, our parents, that generation, my parents have been married over 60 years. My in-laws over 50. People truly live till death through their part in that generation. But it hit Colleen and I. We're sitting there, you kind of think, you know, it's important that we follow that example of our parents' generation. Because we're almost there. We're getting closer. Oh, we are really getting old. It's a joke. I'm not saying my parents are old. Who would dare say that? Let's go to Proverbs chapter 5. Proverbs chapter 5. This was an era, and we see it in the church, people that, yes, They marry and they stay loyal because they believe God ordained it that way. And there's a commitment to be made and you stick with it. They believe in this kind of approach. Proverbs chapter 5 in verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? You know, are you going to just go out there and live like the rest of the world and squander every good thing? No. Verse 17, let them be only your own and not strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. That generation was taught to get married, rejoice with the wife and the husband of your youth, and build a life together through everything. Commitment, faithful commitment. That's what the church teaches. That's the example that's been set to us. Verse 19, as a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. Never quit loving. Always be enraptured. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Faithful commitment. Love that does not die. We've learned that. You know, in summary, learning from the generations is critical. We looked at just a few examples of a generation and we extrapolate it to what we see in the church. The strength of the church is the fact that generations now sit here. Generations accept the calling. Generations learn that they have to own the calling just like their parents did, just like their grandparents did. They have to own it. It's not dad's and mom's religion. It's not my grandparents' religion. I have to own it. It's God's religion. It's His truth. That's what we've been taught by the generations. We have to own it and answer for it. I told my daughters since the time they were little and they could understand, what we will teach you, what you will learn about God and His truth and His way of life and the future He has for you, it's not ours, it's His. And we've told our daughters from the time that they are young, you will have to own this before God. Younger generations, you own it. The generations before you have come, you must be responsible now. You must take it on. Because not only must you live it and accept your calling, but you have to set the example and pass it on to your next generation and the next generation. The church depends on that. The church depends on it. Honor, learn, and pass it on. Let's go to Psalm chapter 78. Psalm chapter 78. We'll end on this set of verses today. It summarizes the power of the generations and how God has looked at it. You know, God does say in other parts of the Bible, He says, if you humble yourself before me and obey you, things will go good. I'm a merciful God. I'm a loving God. But if you don't, it will play out badly for 3 to 4 generations later. But He also says, if you obey me, I will bless up to 1,000 generations, He says. Up to 1,000 generations. Psalm 78 talks about how we take what we have seen and we learn this example of obedience, commitment to God. Psalm 78 and verse 1, give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord. That is the responsibility for every generation. To tell the praises of the Lord. What He's done in our lives. What He's done in our parents' lives. Our grandparents' lives. We have to teach that to the next generation. It says, and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. Verse 5, for he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. All of us own this. All of us. Not just the first generation. Not just the second generation. But all generations sitting here, you own this. God has called you to this place at this time to learn as the generations. We own it. We answer to God. No one else answers but us individually to Him. That's what this is telling us. We must teach the next generation. Verse 7, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. Live according to His way of life. And may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Who is the greatest generation in the church? Well, in a way, we look at this first generation and we say they are a great generation and they'll never take credit, and we won't necessarily give just them the credit. The credit goes to God. But really, the greatest generation will always be that generation, that next generation, that chooses to look at the previous generation and see how God has worked in their lives and how they submitted to God, to incorporate that in their own lives, to accept the calling, to live it, and to pass it on. All that glory goes to God. That is the most important challenge in the church today, because we are soon not going to be a first-generation church. There may be some, but we're not trending that way right now. We are a church that is becoming a second, a third, and a fourth. Who is that greatest generation? It's the one that commits, like previous generations, to God's truth, to His way of life, and to His plan, and goes forward. Honor, learn, and pass it on.